Hi, I'm Mickey Lowe.
Hi, I'm Bishop Todd. And welcome to the C4SO podcast.
Well, welcome back, everybody, to yet another week of the C4SO podcast. Bishop Todd, it's great to be here with you. So we just wanted to say real quick before we get into, you know, today's episode is we've loved getting to hear from you all, our listeners. We so enjoy hearing your feedback. We love your questions. And it's always encouraging to hear that you guys enjoy these conversations as much as, you know, Bishop Todd and I do. So keep them coming. Feel free to respond to those emails. Ask away if you've got any questions. Or if there are people that you'd be interested in us hosting, we love to hear from you guys.
Yeah, that's right, Mickey. We would love to hear suggestions for guests. You know, like we do this to serve our diocese. And So if there are guests that would serve our diocese well, that'd be great.
Yes.
Today we have our friend Scott McKnight, who's a canon theologian in C4SO and a well-known professor and author. In fact, just the other day, Andrea Willits, you know, does communications for us. Her and I were joking that he writes books faster than we can read them. I mean, I've lost track. I think he's written going on 80 books and, you know, many commentaries on the Bible. He's just finished a translation of the New Testament. He is prolific with a capital P.
Yes. Yes. A writing machine. Today, we get to talk to him about his book with Cody Matchett. They wrote Revelation for the Rest of Us, a prophetic call to follow Jesus as a dissident disciple. So we get the chance to hear him talk about what it means to be a dissident disciple, how to read Revelation imaginatively, and just really give us kind of a fresh perspective and just share with us how we can read Revelation well and what it means for us to be dissident disciples. So,
yeah, I thought it was a really fresh take, and I can't wait for people to hear this episode. So I know from our pre-work that you're a little nervous talking to the Reverend Dr. McKnight today.
Yes,
We'll get a little more to that later, but Mickey, meet my friend Scott McKnight.
Yes.
Scott, this is Mickey Lowe.
It's so great to meet you, Scott. Yeah.
I'm nervous talking to the bishop.
Yeah, we'll all just be nervous together.
Unfortunately, we don't get to see each other in person very often. Yeah. So I'm used to seeing you in your basement where you read and write and conduct your scholarly life. But we always like to start these podcasts with a little bit fun. What's your favorite thing to do outside of your basement? Like when you want to escape, where do you go?
Well, we go for walks every day. So we walk about 8,000 to 10,000 steps a day. And then we get to do bird watching. So bird watching, walking. I love to play golf, but I don't play very often anymore.
Channeling a little John Stott there. I didn't know you were a birder.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Look at that.
I had conversations with John Stott about birding. Yeah.
Wow.
See, there you go, Mickey. There's just another reason to be nervous right there.
Yeah. Okay. So, Scott, this is actually something that I wanted to ask you because, you know, as Bishop Todd mentioned, like, I sort of get intimidated talking to all these cool people that I've gotten to meet over the course of this podcast. We wanted to ask you, who has intimidated you in the past or even now? Like, who gets Scott McKnight intimidated?
No, this was a long time ago, but let's say 25 years ago. I scheduled a coffee with Tom Wright in Atlanta at an academic meeting. And I saw him across the street. He didn't know who I was.
Okay.
And I just kept on walking. I didn't know what I was going to ask. But I once had breakfast with E.P. Sanders, a great scholar who was at
Duke. Yeah.
And that was pretty intimidating. And he said to me, this was in the days of actual letter writing. And he said, should I bring my reading glasses? Oh. So I asked someone what that meant. And they said, well, he wondered if you were going to be boring.
Oh, boy.
So, Scott, we're glad to have you today to talk about your new commentary. Man, I know, Scott, I'm really grateful to see a new commentary on Revelation. You might know this about me, but I'm not sure that, you know, I grew up in that Hal Lindsey, Chuck Smith, Pat Robertson, John Walvoord era. In fact, I noticed today that The Late Great Planet Earth was published 1976, the year I was converted. And I don't know if I've ever told you this story, but my first job in the ministry, I was 19. I was the United Methodist youth pastor, and I got fired for showing a thief in the night. So I am your poster child for a lot of what you're working against here.
Yeah.
So my real question was, is, as I was preparing for this today, do a little bit of history of doctrines work for us to get us started here. What do you think was happening in the 60s through the 80s or into the 90s with Left Behind? I don't even know if that was properly scholarly, other than maybe John Walvoord at DTS. But what was in the air, you think, that was driving that sort of dispensationalist thinking?
Well, yes, Todd, thanks. You and Mickey are kind to have me on. There's a new book on this by Daniel Hummel, The Rise and Fall of Dispensationalism.
Okay.
And so he's enlightened me on some of this. But I think the way to put it is dispensationalism as a system was sort of for the super pious in the Plymouth Brethren, conservative, evangelical, fundamentalist world. But when it went pop dispensationalism, yeah. I think, now there were some people like William Larkin, who did the famous charts.
Yes, yeah.
And that kind of provided everybody a grasp of what was going on. But people like Salem Kurban, who was the predecessor to Hal Lindsey, who wrote a book called Guide to Survival, which was a manual for people who didn't get raptured.
Okay.
He couldn't write a lick, but he could tell a pretty good story and create a pretty good theme. Then he wrote 666, and then he wrote 1000 to write these. But Lindsey comes up right after Kurban was doing his stuff. And Hal Lindsey, I learned in this book, I don't remember this. He had a co-writer with the late, great Planet Earth. I don't remember that at all. And I don't remember that her name was on it. Her name was Carol. I think that the, let's just say, the style of writing really grabbed people's attention. It was catchy. Everything was kind of almost advertising. There was the post-Billy Graham revival, fear of communism.
Yeah.
There was the rise of the 60s generation in California, of which you were a part.
Yep.
And the breakdown of morality. There was just a fear of the United States falling apart that gave fundamentalists and dispensationalists something to anchor into. And the pop dispensationalists led that way. And then they got John Walvoord to begin writing popular dispensational eschatology books, like on the Mideastern oil crisis,
and stuff like that. Mm-hmm.
So I think it was a social tension that gave people a desire to want to believe this. And I felt this way when the Left Behind series came out, is that this was the Bill Clinton era, when people were absolutely persuaded that the Reagan era was over and the world was going to the pot again in more than one way. But also Tim LaHaye was critical in this. Now, Tim LaHaye actually wrote a commentary on the Book of Revelation, and I read it in college, or I got almost free copies at Zondervan. They had so many. They had Hal Lindsey books stacked up in corners. They had so many of them, they didn't know what to do with them. But Tim LaHaye connected the Book of Revelation, dispensationalism, to what he called secular humanism. And he saw it, Daniel Hummel describes it as a pre-tribulation tribulation, is that it was going to, America was going to fall apart, and we still had a chance to change the tide. So when dispensationalism got combined with conservative politics and social activism, political activism by the conservatives, dispensationalism's pop dispensationalism became a thing that gave people meaning and hope.
Yeah.
So I always think that the rise of books on dispensationalism like this, the pop dispensationalism, is connected to social crisis. I remember when Stan Gundry at Zondervan sat down with lunch with me one day and laughed and told us that they rejected the Tim LaHaye, Jerry Jenkins Left Behind series because eschatology didn't sell anymore.
Oh, shoot. Oops. Oops.
Just ask Tyndale.
Yeah, you know. Right.
Dang. Yeah, I have my own memories of the Left Behind era. I'm a child of the 90s. I was telling Bishop Todd earlier that I was so scared after reading the series, and then I watched the movies, and I was terrified, and I knew that I was a Christian, but I would pray the prayer just in case because I didn't want to get left behind. My husband has stories of like waking up on Saturday mornings and his parents wouldn't be in the house. They would be out working in the yard, but he didn't know that. And he would wake up and his parents would be gone and he was scared that he was left behind. Yeah. Like is the whole thing that I think a lot of people my age are marked by this fear kind of as an effect of this whole movement. So a lot of us have heard of Revelation and know about Revelation. We know about it, but we tend to stay away for many of the reasons that you name in your book. But there is wisdom in reading Revelation, and then you actually invite us to read it a little bit differently. So we'll get into that in a second. But for some context, can you tell us about the book of Revelation? Who was it written to? What is this style of writing to kind of help us start understanding?
Yeah, instead of writing a straightforward commentary, the book has commentary elements to it. It's sort of a book on how to read the book of Revelation.
So
in a sense, it's reading the book backwards, just like Romans. But the authorship debate is always going to be a debate. The book wasn't received as quickly as some other books, but I think it's somebody named John connected to the Apostle John, could be the Elder John who was connected to the Apostle John. I tend to think that our ability to know authorship gets pretty flimsy when we flip the arguments the other way. So I think John is writing to seven churches in Western Asia Minor. These are literal churches who are experiencing the Roman Empire in ways that they're not even aware. And John is writing, I believe that this is a pastoral apocalypse, trying to teach believers in Western Asia Minor, this early generation of Christians, how to understand the Roman Empire and how, as believers in Jesus, Christians should live in the empire. So it's sort of like a discipleship manual for those who are living within the reach of Babylon, which is what John's term for Rome is. I believe John was writing to a first century church, and I think they would have received these as something very important for them at that time. I don't think he was predicting things that were not their day, but were instead 20 centuries later. I doubt very much that that's how this book worked.
So, Scott, you say that you and Cody make some work of recent scholarship, and I'm not aware. I just haven't tracked everything. This, new commentaries or even new hermeneutics, new ways of reading Revelation. Is there anything that stands out quickly in the newer commentators or something who you and Cody were working with?
The book of Revelation has been understood in rigorous ways as apocalyptic since the turn of the 20th century with a great scholar in England by the name of R.H. Charles, who produced two volumes of Pseudepigrapha and Apocrypha that we used forever until the more recent versions came out in the 80s and 90s with James Charlesworth. So it's been apocalyptic. And this is what is strange, is that the average evangelical layperson has instincts to read the book of Revelation in a way that is pop dispensationalism or dispensationalist. The average scholar in the United States, and I mean just typical New Testament people who study the book of Revelation, never read the book that way. They read the book as an apocalypse, and they know that apocalypses are sort of like inside information about what's really going on in the world. And they understand it not as predictions about whether Putin is the Antichrist, Beast 1 or Beast 2. They're not worried about Joseph Stalin. They are trying to figure out how this book worked in the first century in light of all these Jewish apocalypses that we have. We have hundreds of pages of Jewish apocalypses that clarify this. So the standard commentaries say Craig Kester or Stephen Smalley, all the work by Richard Baucom. Michael Gorman has a marvelous book called Reading Revelation Responsibly. All these books are compatible with what Cody and I do in this book in teaching a hermeneutic. I don't like to refer to our approach as idealist, although some people would call it that.
Yeah.
I like to refer to our book, our approach as theopolitical hermeneutics. It is teaching people how to be disciples by seeing politics from a divine point of view.
Yeah. So, Scott, time out, professor question for our listeners who don't have MDivs. What's hermeneutics mean?
Hermeneutics is the science of interpretation.
Yeah. So it's a big part of what you and Cody are doing. As you said, this isn't a book with tons of small type exegetical precision. You're actually giving us a hermeneutic, a way of reading Revelation, correct?
Yeah.
So Scott, one of the things that we wanted to ask you was, you know, in terms of all the different readings and interpretations of Revelation, what are some of the dangers of getting caught up in more speculative readings of Revelation?
Yeah. Well, that's a good question. And I decided to lock onto this term speculation for a reason, is I believe that some interpretations, some approaches to the book of Revelation are almost completely shaped by who in the modern world is doing what in the pages of the book of Revelation. So who is beast from the sea? Who is beast from the land? Who's the false prophet? Who are the 144,000, et cetera? One thing after another.
And this is what we did every Saturday night, Scott.
I know.
Come on.
Yes, we did. We did read the Bible that way. And people would say, you got to read the book of Revelation with a newspaper in your hand and watching the news to see what is being fulfilled. I mean, I went to college with people talking about this all the time. I tell my students this all the time. Every one of those people has been wrong.
Yeah.
This is pretty significant. You know, if you are wrong every time you plant beans, you figure out a different way to do it.
Yeah.
And people have continued to think, well, we were wrong. We were wrong about Kissinger being the Antichrist, and we were wrong about Gorbachev with his birthmark, and we're wrong about this, and but maybe it's Putin.
Yeah.
I think that's a complete failure, but it's only a partial failure because they're on the cusp of seeing how the book actually works. Mm. And that is, instead of, number one, speculating about who's doing what, and number two, then thinking that we're going to escape this period. The third thing I would say is we need to realize that there are a lot of antichrists. John says this in 1 John, and that Babylon is a trope or an image for tyranny, for dictators, for political corruption, for empire, and that there are so many antichrists, so many Babylons in the world today that we need to be discerning so that we can recognize in our own government, United States of America, or Canada, or England, political corruption that corresponds to what John is talking about, so that we can become people who resist the injustices of the world and fight for what is right and follow the Lamb in that way. So I think the danger is that we will lose the opportunity to become discerning, wise followers of Jesus who recognize political corruption when they see it. I mean, it doesn't take a whole lot for us to look over the presidents of my lifetime and say, John Kennedy, Nixon, Reagan, Clinton, Obama, the Bushes, Trump, this is where they went. This is where they left the path of justice and what is right. And that we can also see things that they've done right. Christians don't have to line up with a political party. They can become discerning agents of Jesus in the world who recognize corruption because they've let the book of Revelation teach them that there are corrupt powers working against the people of God in the world. And we need to see it and call it out.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned our mutual friend Tom Wright earlier, Scott. I think I might have told you this story over the years, that the first big aha moment, and I don't know what I would have been reading when it was 25 years ago, when I first started reading Tom, that the biggest thing he gave me was the gift of a new eschatology.
Yeah.
Because I was 19 years old. I didn't have any way to critique the popularized dispensationalism that we are all imbibing. And like I said, it really did become almost like a parlor game. Now, that's maybe a little unkind, but we literally would sit around talking about this stuff all the time and trying to guess who's who and what's what and all that. And so I want to say that in line with that, your book has done a very similar thing for me in that you focus so much on discipleship. And so before Mickey gets to the next question about your book, I just wanted to say, as I think back to those times, you're right. All that speculative stuff, it takes us out of reality, either our own, or realities on the ground that were right in front of us. Because what else was happening in the 60s and 80s? Well, you had issues of race, you had issues of women. There was all sorts of cultural issues happening right under my nose in the mid 70s. And, we never talked about that kind of stuff. But you're right. Yeah. We wanted to know who Babylon was and where Babylon was. And was it in Iran and, et cetera, et cetera.
Was the temple going to be rebuilt? Well, yeah. You either read Tom Wright's Jesus and the Victory of God, but my guess is you read The Challenge of Jesus.
It is. That was the first book I read, The Challenge of Jesus.
Yeah, and that book provided a different eschatology.
Yeah.
And it was, you had maybe had been exposed to George Ladd, not quite.
Yes, I had, yes. You had,
and George Ladd, it's George Ladd, his Tom Wright's on the inaugurated eschatology of, of now and not yet. Mm-hmm. And it completely reframes things.
Yeah.
But one of the big things that happened is, with people like George Ladd. George Ladd was a vociferous critic of dispensationalism. And he wrote an amazing book called Crucial Questions About the Kingdom of God that effectively, in some ways, dismantled the dispensational eschatology about the kingdom of God. But they really made a big distinction between Israel and the church.
Yes, yeah.
But the entire Reformed tradition, the Catholic tradition, the Orthodox tradition, right. was completely otherwise is that there is one covenant God makes with Abraham, and the church is the new covenant, but it's not a new dispensation. It's the fulfillment. Right. So that eschatology really makes dispensationalism uncomfortable for people who grew up thinking like George Ladd or Tom Wright. And I grew up in that too. I remember I was at Erdman's bookstore the day George Ladd's Theology of the New Testament arrived in boxes. Wow. And I got a copy for $1.90. I have it on my shelf over here. It's over here on the shelf, and it's all
that's bragging rights. I'm sorry, Mickey. I know you want to get to this other question, but Scott and I are just being old guys here. I was introduced to Ladd through Wimber because Wimber was making hay of Ladd in terms of inaugurated eschatology. And it's fascinating, Scott, that lots of us who grew up in Calvary Chapel with that kind of dispensational thinking, we couldn't see how clashed these two worldviews were. Like, it didn't make us automatically rethink the rapture or something. It's fascinating now when I look back that we were kind of holding these. Well, first of all, we weren't very educated and we weren't really thinking that much at all. But just imaginatively, we kind of held these two things together. The kingdom was here, inaugurated, as Ladd said, but we're still speculatively looking.
That's the way our brains work. If we think with the pattern of dispensationalism and we encounter George Ladd or Tom Wright, some inaugurated eschatology, we assimilate inaugurated eschatology to our dispensationalism.
Yeah.
And this has been my criticism of Dallas Seminary for 40 years, is that they assimilated so much of George Ladd, it's no longer dispensationalism. And the old-time dispensationalists will, like Bob Soucy, would say that contemporary progressive dispensationalism at Dallas Seminary is not even dispensationalism anymore because they've assimilated too much. And I didn't see it like that at first, but over time I began to realize they were incompatible systems.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm from Mifflin Quokka is my name.
Saludos, my name is Jonathan Kinberg. And we want to together invite you to our second annual Diaspora Network Conference. Our theme this year is mutuality and mission. What does it look like for immigrants and the broader North American church to really partner together?
The conference will be on July 28th and 29th in Austin, Texas, and it's for immigrants and leaders from C4SO who want to partner with the nations here. See you soon.
So Scott, one of the things that I found really refreshing and really appreciated in the beginning of the book is that you and Cody invite readers to think imaginatively about Revelation. Tell us more about this invitation and how it can help us read Revelation and start to make more sense of this book.
One of the most common words John uses is saw. I saw. Mm-hmm. And when John starts describing a vision, if we let John do what John is trying to do, we will try to see what he saw. Mm. And that means we will enter into an imaginative world. It's sort of like going into Narnia or into Middle Earth, mm-hmm. or if people read Harry Potter, which I had never have, if they'll go into whatever, I don't even know what Harry Potter's world is. I know it was filmed in New Zealand. It will take us there. So when John starts describing the woman of Revelation 12, we have to let this woman take us where John takes us in the vision. Mm. So if we get caught right away, and I think this is what happens. If we get caught up right away and say, who is this woman? We will say, is this Israel? Sounds like Israel. Oh, is this Mary? It sounds like Mary. And then is this the church? It sounds like the church. Well, that right there, if we get stuck, say, no, it's got to be Israel, then we're forcing the image to fit our theology. Or if we let John take us where he takes us, he has a woman who morphs from Israel to Mary to the church. And then we watch this woman's path, and we realize that this woman that we've imagined now corresponds positively, well, in some way, to the woman of Babylon in Revelation, the whore of Babylon. And John features two women in his vision to describe this. And both of these visions of women are the whole book of Revelation. The book, the story of in Revelation 12 is the whole book. And the story of Revelation 17 through 19:10 about the whore of Babylon or Babylon itself is the whole book. And that's what John does. One image after another that keep coming up. And when we start trying to figure out how they fit together chronologically, we ruin John. Mm. John is not working that often chronologically. Those seven seals, seven trumpets, and seven bowls all end up with Babylon being destroyed. All those are like three different cycles of saying the same thing, progressively worse in some ways, but they're not, I don't think they're chronological. And I think that completely messes up the book, but some people read it that way. But John wants us to see things. He wants us to imagine. And I believe, you know, this book was not read by first century Christians. It was heard by first century Christians. And whoever read this book would have read it to all seven of those churches. And probably in one sitting, an afternoon or an evening. And they just all sit there and someone is reading this aloud. And the people sitting there had never, they did not grow up with Salem Kurban and Hal Lindsey.
And they charts.
They had no categories. They had Old Testament. They knew some Jewish apocalyptic stuff. And they start hearing these visions. They go, oh, this is cool. And their minds are completely taken. The way our minds are taken, say, when we read Flannery O'Connor, they are trying to grab your attention and imagine their world. Mm-hmm. And that's what good writers do. And John does it very well.
So you say that John was trying to help these followers of Jesus be dissidents. Can you describe what a dissident disciple is? And can you maybe give us a couple of examples from scripture or even history?
Okay, a dissident disciple is someone who resists something going on in the world. And in the book of Revelation, followers of the Lamb, followers of Jesus, are dissidents of Babylon. They are resisting Babylon. They're resisting Babylon in two ways. They're resisting Babylon in the public world, the public sector, idolatry, the murderousness, the militarism, the arrogance of Rome. Everywhere they go, they encounter Rome in all these seven church areas, cities. And they're also dissidents of Babylon creep in the local churches. Because if you look at the sins of the churches in Revelation chapters 2 through 3, they are the sins of the harlot of Babylon that is creeping into those churches. So they become double dissidents. They resist the way of Babylon in the public world for themselves, and they resist the creeping of Babylon into the church. Some examples. When Jesus said that his message was the kingdom of God, he was setting up a fight, because the kingdom was Antipas or Pilate or Tiberius, run in Rome by Sejanus at the time. And he said that he was bringing the kingdom of God. So God was going to be the king in some kingdom. That is resistance and that is dissidence. He got himself into a very significant place in the public sector when he said he was preaching the kingdom of God. You know, it's like someone coming in to your church and you're in trouble and they say, we're just going to follow Jesus here. I mean, all of a sudden things can get discombobulated because we're not just following Jesus. Okay. So Peter is another example. In chapters 2, let's say from verse 11, all the way through most of chapter, at least into chapter 4, Peter basically spells out what it means to be a Christian in northern Turkey at the time. And his strategy is, let's be people who do good. Let's not be known for getting ourselves in trouble. They were dissidents by doing good when they didn't have the power to resist. By the time we get to the book of Revelation, resistance becomes the only operative word for John. Now, one other example. Jesus, someone brings to Jesus a coin. One thing you learn in the Gospels is don't ask Jesus a question, because he'll turn you upside down in answering your question. So they say, "Who, you know, should we pay taxes or not?" Now, this is an act of rebellion. To not pay taxes is rebellion against Caesar. Jesus says, show me a coin. Whose image is on it? And so he riddles them by saying, well, give to Caesar what's Caesar's, and you give to God what's God's. And that really doesn't answer the question as clearly as people would like. But that is an act of dissidence for Jesus. And I think that in Luke chapter 23, on trial, someone makes the claim that Jesus had told us not to pay taxes. They heard Jesus pretty well. They at least thought that's something that he may have suggested. When Jesus enters the table, he flips over tables. Those are acts of dissidence. So believers in Jesus who are committed to Jesus, who stare at New Jerusalem all the time, who watch the Lamb all the time, become people who have the capacity to discern corruption. And they have seen the example of Jesus and others who have resisted those ways, and they take courage to follow in the way of Lamb by speaking up and speaking out and acting in such a way that maybe their witness will become a martyrdom. And that's a play on the Greek word, because a witness is also the same word for a martyr.
So, Scott, I noticed when I was looking at your book this morning that you and Cody have a pretty central focus on the Lamb. And I just, for the fun of it, you know, according to Bible Gateway anyway, the word or the phrase the Lamb is used 31 times in Revelation. Well, I don't know how many times I've read the book of Revelation. And I would think of Revelation 4 and 5 right off the bat, but all through the book, 31 times. Why is this important? And is there a vision there that's meant to shape our followership of Jesus with the use of this image, the Lamb?
Oh, I think so, yes. And Jesus, of course, is also the witness, too. So he's the, and that means a martyr for what he is, verbally, but also with his life. Revelation 4 and 5 5 is an amazing scene because there is an aching for someone to open up these seals.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Because there is an aching for justice in the world. Mm-hmm. And they can't find anybody. And then it's discovered that the Lion of Judah has qualified to open the seals. And the lion morphs into a lamb,
yeah,
who has been slaughtered. Well, this sets up the whole book. Mm-hmm. Because now the lamb becomes the Lord of Lords and King of Kings forever and ever. You know, the song that Handel sang is from the book of Revelation. It's the Messiah. That song is about Jesus, who is a victor, and the believers who are attached to him, the witnesses, they are victors because their robes have been soaked and made white by the blood of the Lamb. So they have experienced a life of following the Lamb. The entire book is about a Lamb Christology that is a Lamb who is a victor, but he is not a victor with a sword in his fist, but with a sword that comes from his mouth, is that he slays with the word of God. He is the word mm-hmm. of God. I mean, all these different images are used for Jesus in Revelation. But Lamb is a central category for John's Christology, and it teaches us that the way of the Lamb is a verbal witness to what we have seen and heard and experienced, and we put our life on the line because we follow in that way of the Lamb.
So Scott, power versus anti-power is still a big deal right now in our current culture. And one of the things that you say is that your rereading of Revelation shifted the way that you think about how the church should interact with the powers. Say more about what you mean and why it's important. And then what are the implications for social justice and the church's role in those things?
When we finish off the book, I used the Barman Declaration of Karl mm-hmm. Barth, you know, and the days of Bonhoeffer and Barth as a sort of I riffed off of that for understanding how Christians are to live. One of my favorite scenes in the history of the church about Karl Barth was when he was in Göttingen as a young professor, called to a court because of Hitler's requirement to say Heil Hitler to begin classes. And when Barth was called before the judge, he expounded the first commandment. Shall have no other gods before you. Mm-hmm. And that is the Christian approach to power, is that we, in a sense, we go along with it so long as it allows witness to the Lamb. But when the witness to the Lamb is silenced, we speak up. So the book of Revelation teaches us about power, that the way of power is the way of the Lamb. The Lamb is the victor. Randy Harris says, the book of Revelation can be reduced to 3 simple sentences. God's team wins. Choose your team. Don't be stupid.
That's team. A sermon series right there.
Hey. That's right, isn't it? Don't be stupid. The Lamb is the victor, but the Lamb's victory is as a result of the cross and the resurrection. So power is flipped and changed. God will rule in the end, mm-hmm. and victory will be had. And an apocalypse is going to apocalypse. You know, it's gonna have scenes of victory and defeat and battles. That's what apocalypse does. And so the minute John chose to write an apocalypse, he chose to use language that for us could make us at times a bit nervous about war and battle and victory and blood and gore. But that's what he chose to do. But I think that John ultimately says power is going to be for the people not who wreak vengeance in the world, not for those who silence the voice of God in the world, but for those who follow in the way of the Lamb. And he wants to present a victory for the people of God that eventually justice is going to win. And the powers that are used against justice will eventually be unraveled, exposed, and defeated and eliminated.
So here's a fun professorial question, Scott, that I hadn't thought of till this second. Do you think it's fair to say that Paul's more careful explaining of the disarming of the principalities and powers in this cruciform way, is John giving us evocative imagination for the same dynamic?
Exactly. Okay. I've taught this in my classes. Is that Jesus talking about the demons? Mm-hmm. Paul talking about the principalities and powers, in Ephesians and Colossians in his prison series. John takes this and it gets on steroids and just becomes apocalyptic. Instead of making it sort of descriptive and analytical and just elusive in a couple statements here and a couple statements there, John just goes full bore with this. So John's apocalypse of the cosmos, of the beast, of the dragon, of the woman, of Revelation 17, 18, and 19, that's Paul completely explained.
Yeah.
And it's so much more. Who would you rather read? Principalities and Powers or Revelation 6 through?
Yeah, fair point.
Yeah.
Mickey and I are both students. We could yes. pepper Professor Scott all day with questions, but we want to get to a couple kind of more fun closing questions.
So, thinking as someone who is in ministry right now, a lot of the work that you guys do, especially toward the end of the book, is trying to cast this vision for us as the church, as Christians, trying to navigate how to deal with things like political conflict with the powers that we're kind of battling. What would be your encouragement, Scott, to those of us who are in pastoral ministry, trying to teach those that we disciple, so the people that God has placed in our care, to think about these things from a Christian perspective and through the lens of what we learn through Revelation?
This, to me, is one of the great questions about the book of Revelation. Because of the speculative approach, we have failed the church. And we have kept the church from thinking theopolitically. Mm. We don't think that way. So instead, we line up with political parties. Mm. That is one thing. Here to me are the three W's of Christian living to help people think about the book of Revelation. And more importantly, to think theopolitically in the church in a way that becomes a glory to Christ. The first is we need to have wisdom to recognize Babylon and to discern its presence. The second is we need to become witnesses of Jesus in our life by what we see. I mean, that we have seen him, we have heard him, we have experienced him, and we tell our story of that in the context of the church. And the third is we need to become worshipers of the Lamb. There are at least 9 songs, I think, David Olney in his 3-volume commentary on Revelation says there's 16 songs in Revelation. Some people are pretty good at finding little snippets here and there that could be songs. But there are at least 9 solid songs in the book of Revelation. Here's what I would say. The more we worship the Lamb, the more discerning we will become and the more effective our witness will be. One of the biggest things we can learn from Revelation is we need to worship the Lamb. Because we don't worship the Lamb, we fall for Babylon. When we worship the Lamb thoroughly and become so intoxicated with the Lamb, we see Babylon immediately. Those who stare at New Jerusalem, who worship the Lamb, are the first to recognize the corruption of Babylon.
There's the mic drop moment right there, Mickey.
Yes. Yeah.
So, Scott, amazing. Give us those 3 W's again really quick. Wisdom.
Yeah. Wisdom to discern political corruption.
Second.
Witness.
Oh, yeah, witness. Okay.
Witness to of our experience to the Lamb, putting our life on the line. And the third is worship.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The book of Revelation has 9 songs that teach us to worship. And I think the African-American New Testament scholar Bryant Blount taught me something that is maybe one of the most exciting things I learned in the writing of this book. was the songs of Revelation are somewhat like the African-American spirituals, that they use the language of the slave master to subvert the slave master. So you sing those songs without saying one thing about Babylon, but the whole time you're talking about Babylon. I love that. I think true worship will teach us not to worship Babylon, but we'll see Babylon because of it.
Well, I was going to ask you a final question, but you answered it, Scott. You know, I know when guys like you write books, you're trying to say something, and we could all read your book and ask, what does it mean? But I know you're also trying to do something, and this is just fantastic. You're trying to give us wisdom, encourage us to witness, and in worshiping the Lamb, we lose any heart for empire. And as Mickey said, we become dissident disciples. Well done, man. May it be so. Yes. May it be true.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks so much for tuning in to the C4SO podcast. If you like what you heard, please feel free to share this episode and subscribe and leave a review. It helps us to get the word out. Thanks.